Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
This episode is sponsored by Tyndale House Publishing. In Change Your Brain Every Day, psychiatrist and clinical neuroscientist Dr. Daniel Amen draws on over 40 years clinical practice with tens of thousands of patients to give you the most effective daily habits he's seen that can help you improve your brain, master your mind, boost your memory, and make you feel happier, healthier, and more connected to those you love. Visit changeyourbrainbook.com to learn more. If you missed the Trauma Super Conference, this weekend is the replay weekend, February 25th until the 27th, 2023. You can watch the replay for free. You will find the link in the show notes. Welcome back. On today's episode, I have decided to re-release an episode that I recorded 2 years ago, because this was such a fantastic episode and it's such an important topic. It has to do with attachment science. And I'm having a conversation with Dr. Tina Payne Bryson. And Tina is the author and best-selling New York Times author of Whole Brain Child and No Drama Discipline. She's a speaker and the CEO and founder of Center for Connection. I hope you find this episode really helpful. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm looking so forward to talking to you. We're going to be talking about attachments and parenting. And in your books, you talk about attachment science. Can you tell our listeners more?
Yes, I'm so glad to get the opportunity to do that. So attachment science, first of all, from a parent's point of view, is not at all the same thing as attachment parenting. So when we're talking about attachment and parenting, sometimes that gets put together and people think about what we kind of know as a parenting approach called attachment parenting, and they're very different. Attachment parenting is sort of a list of behaviors that parents are encouraged to do in order to facilitate their child's attachment to them. And I just want to be really clear that, you know, if parents do those behaviors, they maybe secure have a child that gets securely attached to them or may not. And even if you don't do those behaviors, you can have a child that's securely attached to you or not. So it's not about attachment is never really about a set of behaviors or rules we follow. It's something much bigger than that. So when we talk about attachment science, we're talking about the umbrella of developmental psychology. And we're talking about, or what I'll be speaking from, is over 50 years of cross-cultural and longitudinal research that talks to us about the purpose of attachment, the role of attachment, and the impact of attachment. So when I'm talking about attachment science, I'm talking about the science that tells us that one of the best predictors for how well kids turn out is that they have secure attachment with at least one person. So let's just define what I mean when I'm speaking about attachment. Attachment is a mammal instinct that has the purpose of helping us stay alive. That's the sort of fundamental purpose of attachment. So as humans and as mammals, we are born with very immature brains and we require a caregiver who takes care of us in order to survive. So really, I think about the purpose and role of attachment being fundamentally about regulating our emotional states. So when an infant gets scared startled, a caregiver picks that baby up, comforts it, soothes it, to help it return to a less stressed state. And it's not just about, and we can't separate these really actually very easily, not just emotional states, but regulating our physiological states. So when our infants and later our older children, even throughout our lifespan, actually attachment is a need we have throughout our lifespan, it just looks different, that our infants rely on us to make sure they're not too hot or too cold and that they're fed, you know, that they don't have feelings of deep hunger. And so or if they get startled and their heart's beating fast and their blood pressure elevates, you know, we pick them up, we soothe them, and we actually help regulate their physiological states as well. So that's really what I'm talking about is regulating emotional states, regulating physiological states, which are very tied together. And that when we do that predictably enough, that our children develop secure attachment with us.
Okay. And I'm also thinking that that really helps them also develop the ability to regulate more easily as adults.
Yeah. So when Dan Siegel and I wrote The Power of Showing Up, which really digs deep into this attachment science. And so, you know, I know you had said you'd want to talk about, but really the best predictor for how well we're able to provide secure attachment to our children is not whether or not we had it from our own caregivers, thank goodness, because that's about 40% of the population, but rather that we've reflected on it. So we can dig into that. But where Dan and I go in the book as well is to say, okay, what can you do in the everyday moments to help cultivate secure attachment? And we always love things that help parents easily remember things because we're so overwhelmed. Yeah. And we talk about the four S's, which we can dive into.
Yes.
It's really about being safe and feeling seen and soothed, so that we have that secure attachment that gets built. And really what we're talking about here, Monique, is that when we as caregivers show up for our children, particularly when they're in distress, and that's really what the attachment system gets activated by, right? If we're regulating emotional states and physiological states, those come about in stressed or distressed moments. And right. So when our children are in distress and we show up for them, and help them feel safe and seen and soothed and secure is really about them knowing we're going to see their needs and respond to them sensitively and timely, then this is not, and you know, as we get into this, I can give examples. And it's sometimes when parents hear my examples, they go, well, that sounds really permissive. And it's really important that we distinguish limits from emotional responsiveness, say no to my child's behavior while still really showing up for them emotionally. So it's not about not having limits. We want limits. Limits help our kids feel safe. And then when we do that and we help them, we co-regulate or we help them regulate their physiological and emotional states, their brain develops the ability to do it for themselves. So, you know, in our culture, we're so big on self-soothing and we kind of talk about that a lot, even in early infancy. And really the way that babies and children and adolescents and adults learn how to quote unquote self-soothe is after having many, many repeated experiences of someone co-soothing or co-regulating with them. So when we provide this type of parenting, not perfect at all, but where we're helping our children when they're in distress, we're actually giving their brain, just like when you lift weights and you do repetitions, right? You do reps, your muscle gets stronger. We're giving our kids' brains reps for how to move from dysregulated physical and emotional states back into regulated ones with our presence and with us showing up in the moment. And then their brain is like, oh, okay, I know how to do that. So it really is helping them be resilient. And of course, we know from the attachment science that because it's one of the best predictors for how well kids turn out, and it's, you know, been measured on all these different things, we know that these relationships are changing and impacting how our child's brain develops. And there's tons of messages of hope because it's never too late as well. But what we're really talking about is having a child's brain wired in a way that allows them to thrive.
Yes, yes. And I like that you have those four S's. So can you talk to us a little bit more about the four S's: safe, seen, soothed, and security.
Yes. Yeah. So safety, safe, is of course what we think of it as protecting our children from harm. And most parents are pretty good at that most of the time, right? We watch them near water when they're little, when they're adolescents, we make sure that, you know, they're in decently safe environments and that they're, you know, that they feel competent and safe before they get behind the wheel and all those kinds of things. So it's about protecting them from harm. And we're pretty good at doing that, particularly around physical stuff. But then there's a second part to it that's really important that's often left out of the conversation. And that is about making sure that we are not the source of our child's fear. Now, many of us grew up with parents who talked about having a healthy dose of fear, or children should, you know, put the healthy fear of God in them, you know, those kinds of things.
Right.
But, you know, if we think about mammals in general, like I'm thinking about even my retriever, you know, those kinds of things. Really, it's our job. It's one of our main purposes and roles of attachment. And in fact, I would say that safe, the first S, is the most important one. Because you can't even really get to anything else. If the brain's number one care in the world is about being safe. If a child does not feel safe, if an adult does not feel safe, we are going to move into reactive states. We won't be able to learn or process information in the same way. We won't be able to be curious and explore and those kinds of things. So what we think about here is that, and I'll just give an example for what we would call disorganized attachment in adulthood, in childhood and in adulthood, it's called unresolved attachment. And it's a pattern of attachment where your caregiver, okay, let's think about it this way. If your biological drive is to go to your parent when you are in distress, when you are terrified, when you're in physical pain, what happens then if your parent is the source of your terror, the source of your pain? Then you actually have competing circuits in your nervous system. One that says, go to your parent to help you survive something that's really terrifying, to help you stay alive. But you also have another circuit that says, get the heck away from what's dangerous. And in this case, it is your parent. So in the literature, that's called a biological paradox. And it literally creates disorganization in how the brain processes information. Now that is, and it's actually, it's one of the best predictors we have for mental health issues later in life. Now, again, there's this research is full of so much hope, even if any of us grew up with disorganized attachment, where our parent was terrifying and was the source of our terror. There's all kinds of research that says if we reflect and make sense of those experiences, you know, therapy is really important for people who grew up with that type of attachment. That we really can free ourselves from the way our brains were wired around that and parent in ways that promote secure attachment. So it's never too late. This research is full of hope. But I think, you know, that's obviously a more extreme example, right? Let's talk about the everyday examples that many parents face, and that is around predictability. So, you know, we have a lot of research that shows that we are meaning makers for our children. So if your child hears a scary noise and they look at you and you look terrified, that is really terrifying to your child. Because if the person who's supposed to keep you alive is terrified, something really terrible must be happening and they may not be able to protect you. Whereas if you have a relaxed face and you're like, oh, that was, did you hear that car backfire? That was so loud, wasn't it? Right. And we help them make sense of it in a way that's not frightening. So we have to remember that the brain hates unpredictability. Unpredictability can mean threat and danger for us, especially for very young children. So as parents, there are times we can become unpredictable. And the most common ways that this happens is we flip our lids as parents and we yell, we are unkind. Maybe we, you know, pick up our kid and shove them into their car seat in a way that's a little less than gentle. You know, so anytime as parents, we become unpredictable and we lose it, that can be frightening for our children. Or anytime we're out of control as parents, maybe we're fighting with our significant other or we're yelling at a customer service person. Anytime we have lost control as parents, whether it's directed at our children or someone else, or just our own meltdown, even not even directed at anyone, that can be frightening for children. It makes them not feel safe. We undermine safety. But I am not at all saying we have to be perfect. In fact, when we do that, when we become unpredictable, not if, but when we as parents have moments like that, the key is repair. Because even though your child is like, wow, and you know, Dan and I both share stories about times we lost it in no drama discipline. I share a story about a time I threatened to remove one of my three-year-old's body parts. I said that if he stuck his tongue out one more time, I was going to rip it out of his mouth. That was a terrible thing to do and say. He immediately collapsed to the floor and said, "You didn't make a good choice." And he was right. I did not. But he was mistaken in an assumption that a lot of adults make as well. And that is that we are making willful choices when we are in, you know, flipping our lid moments. Actually, right. we don't really make a lot of choices during those times because we don't have our prefrontal cortex on board to help us think through and make choices. We're just more in reaction mode. But when we have moments like that with our kids, even though in that moment I was unpredictable, I was patient, patient, patient. And then I flipped my lid. I yelled at him. I was unpredictable in that moment. It undermined his sense of safety. But then right away, I made a repair with him. And, you know, that's some version of, "I'm so sorry. I wish I got so mad and I didn't handle that well. I really wish I had done that differently. Was that scary for you? Will you forgive me?" Sometimes I ask for a do-over, but we go and make the repair. And when we make those mistakes and then make the repair, it actually builds resilience, relational resilience for our children, because they then have an experience where, gosh, relationships feel messy and this is uncomfortable and I don't like this. And I don't, you know, what is my mom doing? And what does that mean for me? Right. So they have that moment, that brief moment. And then I come and make the repair. And so over time, our kids are like, "Okay, she was unpredictable. That was really unpleasant. Relationships, this feels icky and messy and conflicty. And I know she's going to come make it right in a minute." So we even create this predictability around the times we know we inevitably will become unpredictable. So it really widens our child's window of tolerance for the messiness of relationships. So that's why it can be really beneficial when we mess up, as long as we make that repair. So that's the key around safety, is when we violate that feeling for them, we make the repair and we return to that. Now, just a couple other really practical things I'll mention, just given our world right now, before I move on to the other three S's, is, you know, because the brain hates unpredictability, right now the world feels very unpredictable. The information is changing all the time. We really don't know what next week or the next month will look like for our kids in terms of schooling, et cetera. We can create predictability intentionally by creating rhythms to our week. You know, I'm encouraging parents to have their kids help them make playlists that they play on school mornings before school, whether they're home or in school. Creating, like, we have lots of rituals around food at our house. Like on Saturday mornings, we always have breakfast burritos. You know, just creating some rhythms. Now, that can be really helpful. And then one other really, really important thing that we can do as parents to build our child's sense of safety is to have a confidence and competence that we've got them. So when you don't feel like your parent has got it, has got you and is going to keep you safe, you have to spend a lot of time with, you have to spend a lot of attentional, cognitive and emotional resources, having to be hypervigilant to pay attention in the world and check every little thing to make sure you're okay. But if you have a parent that you're like, "Oh, they're on it. I don't even need to think about it." They can be curious and explore and play and do all the other important things that build their prefrontal cortex. So right now we have a lot of parents that are saying things where their kids are overhearing, like, "Why in the world is the school doing this? This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And this is not going to end well." And then we tell our kids, you know, "It's time to go to school tomorrow." You know, that sort of undermines their neuroception of safety. So saying, you know, "I'm not sure how this is going to look when you go back to school, but I trust that your school is figuring it out and doing things safely, and I'll check into it." Right. So it's like, "I've got you." And another way we can do that is by using safety-based language instead of threat-based language, not just around the pandemic, but around all kinds of things. But I'll give a pandemic example. So instead of saying, "You can't see grandma because it's dangerous. You have to wash your hand. You go wash your hands because I don't want you to get sick." Instead of using those, which are threat and danger-based, which then kids can generalize, right? And then they're like, "Everything's dangerous," because kids make generalizations until they become specific. Meaning when we say doggy and there's a head and a tail and 4 feet, 4 legs, then they see a goat when they're little and they're like, "Doggy." And you're like, okay, so they generalize new information until it becomes more and more specific. So when we start saying this is dangerous and this is dangerous and this is dangerous, and we're giving them lots of repeated experiences focused on danger and threat, that can become generalized and kids can feel really anxious about everything in the world. So instead, we want to use safety-based messaging, and we want to say, we're taking a break from seeing grandma right now so everyone can be safe. We're washing our hands so that we can stay healthy. So we're still setting those same limits, but we're focusing on safety so that what gets generalized in this association machine of a brain that we have is, my parents got me. She's keeping me safe so I can relax into being a kid. And so then they say, when we say, hey, it's time to go see grandma, or you can go back to school or whatever, they have this repeated experience of, my grownups have got me. I am safe.
Oh, I just love that. And there's so much intention in this. It's just great.
And the good thing is, too, is as we keep saying it to our kids and have our focus there, it changes our neuroception for safety, yeah. Right? And so, you know, what we focus on and what language we use matters. It impacts us. Okay, so let's move on to scene. Scene, I think, is probably really hard for, maybe I would say the hardest, but scene and soothed are, I think, the hardest. Scene is about, ultimately, we want our child's experience after their growing up years to look back and say, my parent knew me and loved me and loves me for who I am, not who they wanted me to be. But in the micro moments, everyday moments, when your kid is afraid of a spider or doesn't want to get out of the bathtub or is having a meltdown around homework, these are all moments that call for us to look not just at the behavior, but at the mind and the internal experience behind the behavior. So the goal there in these micro moments is for our child to feel felt. And so what we really want is for our child's internal experience and what they're coming to us with and the way we respond to be a match. So let me give an example. So my son's in the bathtub. He's having a fit. He doesn't want to get out. I say, it's time to get out. He yells back, I'm not getting out. And I say, you can either get out by yourself or I will help you out. Again, back to, you know, limits and boundaries being predictable, that helps him feel safe. He knows what to expect. And so as I lift him out of the tub and he's screaming, here's where I can practice scene. I can either practice, here's not scene. You know, I don't know why you're throwing a fit. You know, I let you have a bath even when I didn't want you to. And if you keep yelling, I'm not going to read stories tonight. When we do that, our child is like, okay, now I know that when I share what I feel with her, and it's often a behavioral expression, right? Like a tantrum. My parent doesn't want to hear it. Like if I say, I don't want to hear it. Our children internalize that and it doesn't change how they feel. It's not like he goes, okay. And when they're in a full on tantrum, right? It's not like he goes, okay, well, I'm going to be calm now. And thank you. Or we say to our kid, like they're afraid of a spider. We say, there's nothing to be afraid of. Like spiders are not going to bite you. These are just daddy long legs, right? Our child doesn't go, okay, great. I'm not afraid anymore. That's so helpful. Instead, what they get is she really only tolerates me. She basically is saying, I'm only interested in being connected to you and being relational with you when you have it all together. And it also communicates to the kid, because it doesn't change how the child feels to berate them or criticize them or minimize their feelings. Then they get information from our response that says, now you're alone in your feelings. So as I'm lifting my kid out of the tub, I practice scene and I say, you're so mad that you have to get out of the bathtub. You were really having a fun time and you wanted to stay in. Is that right? So that the way I'm responding and what he's feeling inside are a match. And what I'm doing is helping him build emotional vocabulary. I'm also practicing what we call name it to tame it in the whole brain child, where we're accurately naming emotions, which actually helps reduce reactivity in the brain and helps them create a making sense process, which is such an important part of our attachment journey, is to have making sense experiences. So, you know, it's really about looking beyond the behavior and looking at how the child feels and responding. Now, when we do that, it can more easily allow us to do the third S of soothed. And soothed is nurturing, helping, comforting, co-regulating. So this is where then I'll just stay with the same example. So I wrap the towel around my son. He's screaming and yelling. And soothing is like, I'm going to help you because you are in distress. That's my job as your secure attachment figure. There are stress hormones running through your whole body right now. and I'm going to show up with my presence. And it's our presence in those moments that matters much more than what we do or say. And so in that moment, I wrap the towel around him and I say, you're so sad. And if you are and angry, if you need to cry for a little while, that's okay. And I'm right here with you as you're upset. Now, what that does, and soothing can also be, maybe you have a surly teenager who's having a rough day. We practice seeing by saying, you know, you seem like you're having a rough day. And we just simply even ask, how can I help? Or we take our kid a snack, or we put on some soothing music. You know, it can be sensory experiences, you know, even bringing them a warm beverage. But we're really showing up in that moment to say, I am here to help you and support you. And when we do that, so when I say, if you need to cry, that's okay, I'm right here with you. It also communicates to our kids, I trust that you can handle your big feelings. And it's okay to feel them and express them. And I can handle your big feelings. And I trust that you're going to work through this. And really, Monique, the difference between adversity and challenges making our kids fragile versus making them resilient is that someone shows up in that moment. I'm not fixing everything. I'm not giving in on my boundary. You know, we spend so much attentional and emotional and cognitive resources trying to figure out what do I do now? And what do I say? And how do I fix this? Right. You know, or what threat should I throw out? When really all we need to do is communicate to our child in whatever way feels right in the moment. I'm here with you. I'm going to walk through this with you. You know, your kid's disappointed about something or feels like something's unfair. And we can just say, it's so hard when we feel like things are unfair. And I will listen, or I'm here, you know, that kind of thing. And it just is actually incredibly liberating as a parent to know that when our kids are having a hard time, we don't necessarily have to fix or do or solve or whatever. It's our job rather to just be present with them as they feel it and experience it. And I think the most important piece of this from an attachment lens is to know that when our children are at their worst, that is when they need us the most. Mm. And so much of the time when they're at their worst, it looks like bad behavior. And that's often when we send them to their rooms or we say, I don't want to hear it. And so we're actually doing the opposite of what our attachment drives call us to do.
I know, you know, Tina, and when my kids are older now, but when they were younger, they were telling us to do time out. And that's what I did. And when I think about it now, it just makes absolutely no sense.
You know, it's interesting. I want to just say this because to you in response to that, but also for all of our listeners, that we should have things as parents that we look back on and go, God, I wish I had thought about that differently. Or I wish I had known what I know now, or I wish I hadn't done that, because that means that we are growing and evolving and changing as parents. You know, if you look back on all your parenting and you were like, I did it just the way I would do it now, it probably means we're not learning and growing and evolving and changing. That's a really good thing.
Right,
and, you know, I came to that realization with my second born. So my firstborn had timeouts. He was actually an introvert. He loved timeouts. He would hit me. Because they were more time ins anyway, but he would hit me and go put himself in timeout. And I'm like, you don't have to hit me, like, by yourself, you know. But my second born, I put him in timeout for something and he wouldn't stay. And so he started running around. And then I was like, well, I can't allow this, right? And so kids need boundaries. And so then eventually, like, I was holding him, restraining him, and we were so angry. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is doing nothing to change behavior, nothing to build skills for him for the next time, nothing relationally. Like, this is terrible all around. So anyway, I'm a big advocate for staying close. And I think, you know, one of the questions I get repeatedly is, okay, I try to connect with my kid. I try to have empathy in those moments. And first of all, you know, their reactive states are contagious. So it's hard to regulate ourselves. And it's so important that we do that, because our job as attachment figures is to be the safe harbor in the storm. And that means we can't be the storm, but we will be. So we make the repair, right? Like we talked about. I think it's, you know, our kids sometimes are like, leave me alone. I don't want to talk to you. And that's okay. Please don't chase them and be like, no, I'm going to give you connection and empathy. Like, that would be really disrespectful. From my perspective, I think the key is presence and availability. So we basically can say, okay, I'll come back and you know, I'm here if you need me. I'll be in the kitchen if you need help. I'll come back and check on you in a few minutes. So it's really about our child knowing that we see their needs and we are available to them to help them, even if they don't want it right in that moment. So this leads us to the fourth S of security. And, you know, the research shows all these amazing outcomes, which is just phenomenal. And based on the outcomes I see in the research, almost all of them are functions of the prefrontal cortex, which tells me that it's these secure attachment relationships that build this prefrontal cortex that allows us to have empathy and insight and sound decision-making and the ability to regulate our emotions and our bodies and have attuned communication and all of these things. So we're not just influencing the minds and behaviors and character of our child, we're actually wiring their brains. So when we provide not perfect, but enough predictable, repeated experiences where our children feel safe, seen, and soothed, they get this fourth S of security. And what I mean by that is that their brains have wired to know, based on all these repeated experiences, that if I have a need, they're going to see it and show up for me. And a more important outcome even than that, or let me say the impact of that is a better way to say it, is that they also then learn how to show up for themselves. They learn how to keep themselves safe and value themselves. They learn how to see and understand themselves. They learn how to soothe themselves, even if that means I better call my mom because I need some support right now. And then it allows them to develop those secure attachment relationships where they expect others to show up for them. So they choose healthier romantic partners and friendship, and they are able to do that for others. And we know that it's our connectedness to each other that is best for our mental health, physical health, emotional health, and just happiness in general over our lifespan. And so then they also can go on to provide it to their children. So as we begin to parent in this way, and it's never too late. Right now, if you're a parent listening to this and you think, gosh, I'm not so great at the four S's, know that your brain is still open to change by doing practice, by practicing parenting in this way. And as soon as you start to make those changes, your child begins to benefit right away, because in childhood and adolescence, the brain is wired to be super adaptive to our experiences. So your child's brain will start to change right away. And so this is just such a powerful and hopeful way to think about what we're doing for our children as we develop them into people. We're changing their brains by simply bringing our presence and showing up, especially at their worst when they're having their hardest time.
That's so great. What recommendations would you share with parents who themselves have experienced trauma?
If you have experienced what we were sort of talking about before, about that disorganized attachment where your parents were frightening, you know, that is really important that we seek out support for that. And we do a making sense process because, and I'll talk about the other patterns of insecure attachment as well. But, you know, one of the things that's so hopeful in the literature as well is that the number one predictor for how well we are able to provide secure attachment to our children is, like I said, not whether or not we had it, but rather that we have reflected on it and made sense of it and continue to make sense of it. It's not a one and done thing. It's not the kind of thing where you go, okay, you know, I went to therapy for six sessions and I talked about my parents, so now I'm good to go. And you have older kids like I do. My kids are 14, 17, and 20. And I'll tell you that, you know, the process of self-reflection and making sense of our histories and story is an ongoing thing. It's, you know, when your kids hit adolescence, new things come up for you to do some making sense about your own adolescence. And so it's really about shining the light of awareness on that. You know, Dan Siegel has a really beautiful analogy about a dog bite. And he says, when a dog bites you, your instinct is to rip your hand away as quickly as possible. But that really shreds the tissue in your hands a lot. If the dog has clamped down and you rip your hand out, and it's really hard for that to heal well because it's not a good, clean, you know, cut. And so what he says that you're supposed to do, and apparently this is a thing, is when a dog bites you, you're supposed to reach a little further into the dog's throat so the dog gags and releases its grip. So Dan says, if we have grown up with complex trauma, then we need to have the courage to reach into the throat of our stories, our history, and what doesn't make sense. Like we find ourselves as parents maybe dissociating, or we find ourselves as parents getting really out of control and reactive in ways that we're really trying hard not to in a patterned way that we're really concerned. Then we need to have the courage to reach into the throat of our stories and our history so that it can release its grip on us and we can begin to heal, because puncture wounds actually apparently heal very nicely. And we can do that through trauma, through therapy. Now, if you have another form of an insecure pattern of attachment, what's called avoidant or later in adulthood dismissing attachment, where you grew up in an emotional desert and no one really provided you with any of the, maybe you were given safe, but not seen and soothed. Your emotions were minimized. Mm-hmm. You were told, you know, they were lots of, I don't want to hear it. If you're going to cry, go to your room, or you're too sensitive. You need to, you know, roll with the punches better. And you were really left alone in your moments of vulnerability and distress. Or you grew up with what's called anxious ambivalent, or in later in life adulthood called preoccupied attachment, where you had a really unpredictable caregiver, where sometimes they were good at showing up for you and soothing you and helping you feel safe and seen. And then other times you couldn't count on them at all. They were predictably unpredictable, and even sometimes intrusive. And the parent's need is really kind of what rules the relationship. Either of those insecure patterns of attachment as well, you know, therapy can be helpful for those, but we can also walk through something like the power of showing up, where we ask questions to ask people for some self-reflection. You know, did your parents help you feel safe? Under what circumstances did you not feel safe? You know, how did they show up for you? How did they not show up for you? And just walking through that process of self-reflection, either through journals, through a small group or conversations with your significant other or your best friend. So anything that we do to reflect on those stories can free us up to not be ruled by our brain's automaticity around the way we were parented. We begin to shine the light of awareness on them, make sense of them, which can then free us up to be present to our kids so that they can have secure attachment with us.
Okay. How can we show up for our children when we're sort of at our own limits, you know?
Well, you know, and that's very common for all of us and all the time, but especially right now, is we are being asked to do what is more than humanly possible a lot right now, particularly if you're a parent who's trying to work full time and your kids are home full time and you're trying to help them school. You know, that's so much that's required of us. So our nerves are, you know, our nervous systems are really maxed and taxed. The key is that in the moment, and you know, this is particularly the case around discipline, which is a whole other conversation, but the goal of discipline is to raise children who are self-disciplined. So that requires a lot of teaching and skill building. And a lot of the ways we can think about, shift our thinking about discipline is that our job in the discipline moments is always to teach. And before we can do that effectively, we have to make sure, one, is my child ready to learn? In this moment. And if they're too dysregulated and reactive, then we go back to safe, seen, soothed, right? To get them there so that they're ready to listen and you can be effective in teaching and addressing the behavior. But the other important question we need to ask in those moments is, am I ready to teach? Am I regulated? Can I be the safe harbor in the storm? And if the answer is no, the most important thing we can do in that moment is to pause and regulate ourselves. And a couple of just quick mm-hmm. suggestions I'll offer, you know, back when I first started doing a lot of parenting work, you know, most of the stuff that was out there was about teaching parents to count to 10 or, you know, to, you know, try to tell yourself something, you know, very top down where we're asked to use our prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. But when we are reactive, we actually don't do a good job of accessing and using our prefrontal cortex. We're much more of a bottom up approach, right? Our nervous system is kind of taking over. So we really want to utilize bottom up approaches. So some things that can be helpful to regulate us, to pause before we go into that. And by the way, I will say to my kids, of course they need to be safe. So when they're really little, you might need to put them in their crib or something where they're safe, where you walk away and, you know, and get control of yourself. But it's a phrase that I always kept at the ready was, I'm too reactive right now, or I'm too upset right now to have a conversation with you that I'm going to feel good about. So I need to go take a break. And then I'm going to come back and talk about it with you in a bit. And sometimes it came out as, I can't talk to you right now. I will be back later. You know, sometimes it can come out as like, we're going to have a reflective dialogue after I regulate my nerves. Sometimes it doesn't come out that way, right? But it's really important that we pause and get control of ourselves. A couple ways to do that using bottom-up strategies. One, and those of you who are listening, you can do this with us now, is just put a hand on your chest, like over your heart, and a hand on your stomach, like right below your belly button. And just take a deep breath. And make your exhale longer than your inhale. When our exhale is longer than our inhale, it actually down-regulates our nervous system. I'm feeling like I'm about to yell. I'm losing it. I'm too stressed out to do this kind of parenting right now. I will put my hands on my chest and belly, which, by the way, I've done so much over the years when I was trying to regulate myself. My kids know it's also a warning sign. So it's actually really effective. They're like, oh, okay, we pushed her further than we need to push her. So it's actually like harbinger of doom coming if you don't rein it in. But that was an unintended consequence. But I really put my hands on my chest and my belly. I take that big, long, deep breath, or a sigh will work, but it's that longer exhale. Doing that a couple of times really does turn down the reactivity in our nervous system. The other way we can do it is to posture or move our body differently. There's a bunch of really cool research out of Stanford, Amy Cuddy's work, where she had people take on a power posture or a kind of helpless posture. And after 3 minutes, they saw cortisol and hormone changes, which is phenomenal to see that kind of change in a 3 minute period. So one of the things that we write about in No Drama Discipline that came about from a clinical interaction I had with a family as an experiment is to, if you're about to yell, if you stand over your kid and start wagging your finger, you're just going to, and have an angry tone of voice and an angry look on your face, you're just going to further reinforce your fighting circuitry. If you do the opposite, like you want to yell, you're about to lose it. If you sit on the floor in a relaxed posture, below your child's eye level, and it works on your significant other too, below your child's eye level in a relaxed posture, it's basically like that information from your body is like, hey, we're hanging out. We're just listening. We're not fighting. All of that information goes up to your brain and it activates a different neural network. You know, if you're standing there about to yell and you're in a more aggressive posture, you're activating. It's like, anything related to this posture, please get activated, right? And so you get more into that fighting zone or reactive zone. But if you sit in a relaxed posture below eye level and you take a breath, and really, if you can muster it up in that moment, you can even just have this rule in your head. One, say something empathetic about my child's feelings. You're feeling really upset right now. Oh, buddy, you're so angry, something like that. And number two, say, I'm right here with you. And within a few minutes, you will feel your body will let go of that drive to yell and it'll help regulate you. So those are just a couple of things we can do. Singing is super regulating. It helps integrate the brain. So moving your body, singing, laughter, you know, if you can get silly and play keep it up with your kid, these are all ways to release nervous system arousal. And one of the ways I actually think about it is I imagine my nervous system, right? When my nervous system is in high arousal, my heart is beating fast, my muscles are tense, my body temperature goes up. And it's like my volume dial is turned all the way up on my nervous system. So when I'm noticing that, then I'm like, okay, I need to turn my volume down. I need to turn down the intensity of my nervous system. And I often imagine my child having a volume dial too. I know it sounds more like I'm like, where's the mute button? But I really mean turning down their reactivity. And when I imagine that, okay, my child is having a stress response right now, it looks like really oppositional, disrespectful behavior, because that's what kids do when they are in reactive nervous system states. My job is to help turn down that intensity. And when I imagine the volume dial, it really helps me, because then I change my tone of voice. You know, I'm like, oh, wow, what's going on? Instead of, why are you doing that? You know, there's a total different pace and tone in my voice. And the way that we talk to each other, particularly between parent and child, has a big impact on whether or not that volume dial gets turned up higher or whether or not we can downregulate it.
So do you actually imagine, because that's something that I learned in my polyvagal training, was the vagal break. We actually like imagine and you do the motion of turning down, you know, whether it's a switch or whatever, but Do you actually?
I don't usually do it with my hand, like to turn it down or to, you know, if you imagine a dimmer switch going down. But and I'm a huge fan of polyvagal theory. Stephen Porges' work is revolutionary in terms of how we think about all of this. But in my mind, I'm imagining like an old, because I grew up in the 70s. I'm imagining an old 70s stereo dial that starts out blue and goes, or starts out, I think if they start out blue, then it goes to green, then it goes to yellow, then it goes to red. I'm sort of imagining, which actually fits in really well with sort of these zones of regulation as well. I actually imagine it. And I think that's so huge in the moment. You know, if we... we're meaning makers for ourselves as well. So when our children are, you know, if my kid is splashing me and yelling, I'm not getting out of the bathtub. And in my mind, I'm like, he's doing this to make me mad. And, you know, if I have that sort of meaning making, I'm going to respond really differently if I think my kid's intentionally being oppositional and trying to push my buttons versus if I go, okay, my kid's super tired and he is dysregulated right now and he's having a stress response. I'm still going to hold the boundary. I'm still going to say no to the behavior, but I'm going to say yes to his experience. And the way I'm going to do that is imagining, okay, my job is to move him from this really stressed out state back into a regulated state so that his brain gets practiced so that he learns how to do that for himself.
Oh, that's so great. Do you have any advice for like single
parents? Such an important question. I want to say that this idea of the four S's, there are lots of moments as a parent where I'm not sure the exact right thing to do or say, but the four S's is my North Star. It is always the right answer, whether it's my children or my mom or my husband or, you know, whatever. And so that's an easy idea. Okay, I'm going to give four S's as much as I can, but it is not always easy to do, as you know, Monique. And so what that means is that I have to have the capacity to be able to do it. And so that requires that I have people who show up for me. And so as a single parent, it's really important that we find people who will show up for us, who help us feel safe and seen and soothed and secure. And by the way, just because you live with another adult, whether you're married to them or not, does not necessarily mean that that person's good at providing you with the four S's, right? So, you know, sometimes single parents, you know, think, oh, I wish I had someone else. And yeah, just another set of hands, all that's super helpful. But there are a lot of people who are in a relationship and they don't feel like they're getting the four S's from their partner. So it's really important. Yes. Try to work on that. That can be really helpful, but we all need people who show up for us, who help us feel safe, seen, soothed, and secure. If you're a single parent, fine. You probably have friends and family members that do that for you. If not, seek out another parent who you guys can provide the four S's to each other. It's super important. And then the other part of that, that's even more important for single parents, could, because you can't tag team it out, is that you have to show up for yourself. You have to help yourself feel safe and seen and soothed and secure. And sometimes that soothed might be having 2 minutes to pee by yourself. You know, it might be like the bar is low, right? Right now with our kids all the time, but taking, you know, 5 or 10 minutes a day, that's just for you. That's just joyful. Whether it's, you know, I love just junk, crappy TV that's on in the background while I eat my Reese's peanut butter cups and shop online or Google around, making sure we're all getting enough sleep, even more important for single parents, that self-care piece. I know you all know that as you're listening, but you're probably not good at it. Like I'm not good at it. You know, we know that, but it's really important that we show up for ourselves. We show up for others. And I also, you know, when my oldest son left for college, I wrote him this letter, which I'm not going to think about too much because it'll make me sad because I miss him. And it's so sad when our children leave. But one of the things I said in the letter is, not if, but when you feel lonely, when you feel sad, when you feel anxious, know that someone around you is feeling that too. And reach out, do something, like mobilize into, take that feeling that you're having and mobilize it to reduce that feeling in someone else. And, you know, we know from the trauma research that when we have something difficult happen, one of the most important things we can do is to mobilize and help in some way. And when we do that, we're far less likely to experience PTSD. So Mobilize. Right. So single parents, when you're feeling overwhelmed and alone and frustrated and exhausted and exasperated, there's another parent out there feeling that. Reach out. And in reaching out to them, you will get your needs met too. So that's a really important thing that we all need to keep in mind.
Mm. Well, that's great. Tina, I loved this conversation. We appreciate it so much. Tell us how people can get in touch with you or find out more about your work. If you're offering, I don't know if you have any things going on right now.
Thank you, Monique. Feel free to share. My website is tinabryson.com, and I've got all kinds on, it's tons of free content on there. On my blog, I've got a video about safety-based messaging and what kids need most right now and how to reduce anxiety and going back to school. There's all kinds of resources on there. You can also learn about my office hours, which are groups I'm doing for parents right now. There's a large group and a small group where I actually just talk to parents and answer questions the whole time. Almost all of them are about discipline, but that's what we do is those. It's like office hours with me where we just chat and answer questions. The best way to find me on social media, I'm on all channels, but Instagram is where I'm posting the most, and that's Tina Payne Bryson is my handle there. And I want to just say one final closing thought, Monique, before you close us out. And I think this is so important for us all to remember. Again, you don't have to be perfect. I want to remind you, parents, you are a better parent than you think you are. Even in your terrible moments that you feel like you're a terrible parent, you're still your child's superhero. And what your child needs most from you is you. Flawed you, imperfect you, falling apart sometimes you, but you are the most important thing. So just keep building that relationship. That's what your kids need most, is just simply you and your presence.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much. Thank you.